welcome everyone. And we have a small group, so it can be rather intimate, I hope. This is a rather intimate affair, this practice that we do, so it's appropriate. Very close work. First of all, I'd like to dedicate this talk, this time, in memory of a dear friend who passed away some time ago, who's been in my thoughts recently. His name is Steve Stuckey. He's the former abbot at San Francisco Zen Center. Daisu Myogen Daiyosho, Steve Stuckey. Steve was a wonderful presence in this Dharma realm. A very solid person and good teacher, good guide for many people. He was a great help to me, and I felt really supported by him, although I didn't see him that frequently. And you did too as well, didn't you, Joe? Mm-hmm. Yeah. Steve was instrumental in facilitating Joe's coming to Jigoji as well, and joining our little country sangha. Steve was a very strong presence, I would say, very powerful presence, and yet he manifested his presence with real kind of grounded simplicity and modesty. For the last few years, I haven't been very inclined to talk much, to speak in this way very much. And a few years ago, I was at a conference with Steve, and he and I was talking with him, and I was talking about that, what was going on with me, and he said, he commiserated with me. He said, "Yes, we're both introverts, but we're working on it." So it encouraged me to keep this seat. Anyway, I want to thank Steve for helping to bring Joe to Jigoji. Joe's been a great, good priest here and a great presence at Jigoji. And I'd like to remember Steve. And that's why this was read, the self-receiving and employing samadhi, in homage to Steve. This is kind of, maybe this seemed a little over the top for you, maybe a bit, but this is actually a wonderful kind of encouragement, almost a pep talk from Dogen to his sangha, kind of like, yes, you know, do the work, you know. So he kind of, every once in a while, he kind of punched his sangha with a very encouraging words like this, and we're revising our chant book here, and we may include this in our chant. We'll do this more regularly, I hope so. Well, this talk may be somewhat abbreviated because I'm recovering from an illness, some procedures, and things are okay with me, apparently, but I'm still a little in a fragile state, and so maybe a shorter, bit of a shorter talk. It was very nice to practice today with everyone. I felt supported. There were just a few of us in the Zendo. I felt like we created a kind of a bond in this silent practice together. And I don't know, it's subtle. When we do this work, we it always appears that something shifts. It might be very, very subtle. It might even not be recognized, but it feels like there's a little shift. Yes, when we sit, we encounter the momentum of our karmic life, our active life, our issues, our habits, our predispositions, our busy mind. Yet we do meet that. We do recognize it, don't we? Even though in practice it's sometimes a problem. We want or we expect a kind of calm mind or a kind of package of samadhi, and we encounter ourselves again. But I think imperceptibly there's a little shift each time, and it feels almost like a like guerrilla warfare to me. Like it's a conspiracy. We're conspiring, making silence together to shift reality just slightly. Shift it within ourselves and beyond ourselves into vastness, but locally into our life and our shared life with other beings and other things. In other words, what I'm trying to say is what this said is there's, even though you think in your practice there's just little me working on my little mind and my little body and my little life, there's power here. There's power in this practice. There's energy or vitality in this practice. And you don't necessarily have to recognize it as such, but nevertheless, I think that's so. Something's changing as we do this work. Steve said once, I love this quote, he said, "It doesn't take too long to get to now." That's our practice. With my illness, I recently confronted a mind that had to deal with impermanence, with the possibility that my life may be shortened. And it doesn't look like it's going to be so. It looks like everything's fine. But for a while, I thought, oh, better look at that, you know. And one of the things I've appreciated about the teachings of the Buddha and the teachings of this way is the kind of realistic or direct, almost no-nonsense way of looking at the situation that exists for us, that this time that we have is fleeting, that it's just for this moment, that we have, that it's not an easy thing to consider all the time, but it's very good that this practice looks at it in this direct way. That this is a temporal existence and this is for this time and this place only. So it doesn't take too long to get to now. When we look at impermanence, we have to acknowledge that we're dependent. We're totally dependent. We're totally interconnected with all beings and all things. We're unavoidably involved and unavoidably in relationship with all beings, with all things, and we're supported by all beings and all things. And that it's conditioned. It is conditioned. This is conditioned existence. It is dependent on various elements and facts, on its relationship with everything else. This is a kind of hard thing to look at, and yet I think it's important for us to look at it. It was very helpful for me to look at it. I actually, for a time, when I thought I didn't have much more time to live, I thought maybe I would, I looked at things quite differently for a while, and savored, you could say, things in a particular way, and developed a kind of gratitude for very small things, the spaces between the two flowers, something like that. The practice itself is sometimes called, in Japanese it's called gotsu. Gotsu means to be, gotsu-ji, gotsu-za, it means to be even, to be, gotsu I think is a term that means like a plateau, or a kind of level plane. It means to see things as they are, to see life with death, to see birth and death together. So we have our particular existence, we have our particular consciousness, our located consciousness, and yet we all know, don't we, that we're more than our body. Everybody recognizes that, don't you? You're more than your body. You're totally involved with everything else. And you could even say that your sense fields and what you see is part of your body, right? Because your eyes see a shape, see another person, and that scene, and the activity of the scene and the object seen are all connected. So you could say that what you see is your body also, and what you hear. And you could even say what you know, what you're aware of, what you know is also part of your body. So we recognize that we're more than just a body. This understanding of practice or understanding is to see that the particular and or the local or the personal is the same. It's sama. It's the same as, it's utterly involved and connected with and the same as everything else. Anyway, that's the story so far with me. I'm as far as my health is concerned, I'm instantly better, and I'm going to live forever. So watch out. And I have a lot to be thankful for and grateful for, the support of many people. I've been spending some time near the beach, and kind of changing the subject here. There's a sign on some of the beaches. It's at this little beach I like called Bean Hollow Beach, and I think it's at some other beaches as well. It's kind of a stock warning they put on the beach, and it says warning. Warning, first point, warning, watch out. It says strong backwater first, strong backwater. So that's the first point. Second one is sleeper waves. Have you heard these? You've seen this, Holly, haven't you? Sleeper waves. Yeah. And the third one is rip currents. Strong backwater, sleeper waves, and rip currents. So I thought we could just take a moment and examine those three. These are called kleshas, actually. These are the three kleshas. Do you know the word klesha? No? Klesha means to to stain. It means something was originally pure or undefiled, and it's become stained. And traditionally, we say the kleshas are greed, hate, and delusion. Or sometimes it's translated as attachment, aversion, and ignorance or delusion. So strong, these are the obstructions or impediments that we need to look at occasionally within ourselves. These are the things that can stain our way. Attachment or grasping or holding on to or trying to own or trying to reify or trying to take possession of or trying to include within the identification or the making of a self is called attachment. Translated sometimes as just greed, as gathering or acquiring or thirsting or wanting to be, to become, or to hold, or to own. So my interpretation of strong backwater is this kind of habit energy, this tendency we have to attach, to hold on to keep an isolated and a separate self, to hold a fixed view, or to not open not be available or open to another person or a new event or just even a new experience as it is. Sleeper waves, what would you say? I would call that ignorance, right? Delusion. Being, you know, not wanting, this is the aspect of selfing that is not grasping or trying to hold on to, but is actually contracting, is pulling back, is withdrawing, is separating yourself from what's actually happening, what you need to open to, another person, an experience. And rip currents. Any guesses on what that is? Well, traditionally greed, hate, delusion, attachment, aversion, delusion. You could say it's our tendency toward passion, toward attachment to sensual desires. These kleshas are our practice activity to look at these kleshas and to see them as they are. Anyway, that's about all I have to share. Does there anyone would like to say anything?
Vedas wanting things to be different from what they are. Okay.
Greed. Yes. I'm sorry, I'm not too a little out of sorts today, so maybe I'm not too able to present much to you. There's one more thing I'd like to share, though. This is a this is the words of Kovanchino Roshi, kind of the other side of things. This is a manifestation or an expression of what Dogen talked about in self-receiving and employing samadhi. And this is how Colvin kind of expresses the same thing. This is part of the article that was published in Buddha Dharma some years ago, a few years ago. And these are excerpts from Colvin's speaking. And he's talking about the light inside of us, about our spark, our fundamental energy or purity. Kobin said, "Light comes out of people like a firefly. Light is generated inside. Though I do not see it myself, I see it in others. It is not always constant because the support of innumerable others sustains an individual life, and at the same time, one's existence must return the same amount of energy to all. The body is warm and something is burning. When you look for it, there is a light. Eyes are a window, and when discouraged or ill, eyes don't show light. When full of hope, vitality, inside and outside, the eyes shine. It could be recognition of something, or it could be being recognized by it. It is always mutual. Sometimes, sitting is utterly dark, feels like a fermented junkyard or something." Have you noticed? I've noticed that. But once in a while, a forgotten jewel is in there. When I pull it out, it shines. Sensing the light within you is the same as expecting a new day tomorrow. There is a future. There is light coming. And with it, all language, the organ of taste, eyes that are not destroyed by the intensity of seeing, all that was transmitted to us from very long ago to this experience now. My feeling is that nothing is made by me. Everything belongs to the world, especially the very center of my being. I am here, but I do not belong to me." So, I'm feeling better, and thank you all for asking. That was a joke. And I'm happy to be here with you all. And in the sense of understanding, working with our issues, working with these kleshas, with our, what did I call it? The riptide, the
backwater and the sleeper waves.
And the sleeper waves, yes. I want to read just a case from the Shoyuroku. It's the Book of Serenity. And I think I've talked about this before. It's case 36. It's Master Ma is unwell. And this case encourages us to do the kind of work of without that we do when we practice, of without neglecting our body and mind, and without ignoring the particularities of our individual existence, to still holding that local view, you could say, we also hold a bigger view that includes everything and is limitless. So this case is Master Ma, or Matsu Dio Daioji, Basho is also called in Japanese, Basho. The case goes like this. Master Ma was unwell, and the monastery, he was the head of the monastery. Master Ma was this teacher for this monastery, and very important in the history of Zen. Master Ma was unwell, was feeling unwell, and his tanto, I guess you'd say now, or this is the Ino, came, the monastery superintendent came and said, Master, how are you feeling? How's your venerable state these days? And very carefully he asked him how he was doing, you know, because Master Ma was kind of a fierce guy and everyone was a little afraid of him. So, Master Ma said, sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha. Sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha. And actually, on my raksu that I got from Vanya, I have that written here. Sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha. Same from the same case. So, is that clear to everyone? Does anyone got that? Have any idea what that's about?
I don't wonder why he was afraid to ask him. Yeah, that response.
Well, in the early kind of mythology, you could say, or the way they had of describing certain aspects, a sun-faced Buddha in early Madhyamaka, the sun-faced Buddha was a Buddha who had limitless life, basically, could live for thousands of years. And a moon-faced Buddha could only live a day and a night, had a very short life. So Master Ma said, kind of said, so-so. I could live forever or I could die at this moment. So Master Ma said, And again, he's expressing this kind of what I just call a local view, our particular local view, and our in the big view. So, sun-faced Buddha, moon-faced Buddha. I can live forever, and I intend to, and I could die at this, I could just be a day and a night. So that's how I'm feeling. Both are fine.